Pesachim, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Aleph, new Perek, and here we are going to be talking about the halachas that apply to things that are contain chametz but aren't chametz gamur be'en. They're not true chametz that is edible, and that is, whatever you're talking about, is not a majority of chametz. And meaning, you have one of two possibilities. Either it's chametz betaroves, chametz which is included in a mixture of other things, where chametz is less than the majority. Or we'll talk about something called chametz nuksha, which means, literally I think it means hardened chametz, but it means chametz which doesn't really meet the category of chametz in as much as it's not food, either because, and this is really important, chametz nuksha comes in two varieties. The variety A, which Armishan will discuss, is some product which is really industrial nature. It's not designed for eating. So though one of the ingredients is, let's say, wheat flour, but it's not food and not normally edible. So it's going to be chametz nuksha. There'll be another kind of chametz nuksha we'll see elsewhere in the parak that's referring to food that is edible, but that the chametz, the chimut, the leavening process was impeded and didn't complete. So it's not fully leavened. But that's not our topic here. So we're going to have basically four examples of chametz that are included in a tarovus, a mixture, and their minority of the content of the mixture is chametz. And then three examples of chametz nuksha, things that are really industrial materials and that they contain chametz, they're not edible. And in both those cases, according to how the Bar Tanura learns, we're going to say that while eating them doesn't carry the full penalty of karas, they're not really chametz, but one may not keep them around. And on Pesach, according to Bar Tanura, this is just a din derabanan. Derabanan, lest you come to eat these foods on Pesach, which of course is being Isra Doraisa. There are others, including Rashi and the Rambam, who learned that actually keeping them around is an Isra Doraisa to itself. You're over Bal Yerel Bal Yematze. And that will be, that machlokas really revolves around the first words of the Mishnah, which say, Elu Ovrin BePesach. So this is a strange construction. The word Over means to transgress, but normally would apply to a human being who has to do an action to transgress. So according to Bar Tanura, what this means is Avor means to pass over. So Elu Ovrin BePesach means, according to Bar Tanura, these are things that you have to get rid of on Pesach. They have to be destroyed. Because if you leave them around, that would be forbidden midrabban unless you come to eat them, which would be an Isser Doraisa. Others like Rashi learn that Elu Ovrin means people who keep these around would actually be over the Isser Doraisa, maintaining them on Pesach, even though they are only Betarovas, a mixture, or Chametz Nuksha. But let's stick to the Bar Tanura. So Elu Ovrin BePesach, the following seven items have to be gotten rid of on Pesach, four of them because they are a mixture, a tarovus that contain chametz, and three of them because they're chametz nuksha. They're, although inedible and in normal circumstances, not for eating, they do contain chametz, so you can't keep them around. And these are them. First of all, kutach habavli. Kutach habavli, Babylonian kutach, this is some kind of dip they used. It included bread that was moldy, as well as whey liquid. So they would, and some salt, so they would dip it in there. The point is that since there is bread inside here, you have chametz, even though it's batarovas in a mixture, you can't keep it around. Second of all, the Shechar Hamadi, Median beer. So Bavel is in Iraq, modern-day Iraq. Mada is modern-day Iran, Persia. So although normally in the time of the Mishnah, most what we would call beers were really kind of like mead. They're made out of honey or fermented date honey. The Medians, they would add barley and barley water to their beer. So that is kind of like our beer, which contains barley as the primary carbohydrate. So you've got a mixture that includes barley, and barley, of course, one of the five grains that make chametz, and therefore it's a mixture that includes this barley liquid, so it's a tarovus that includes chametz, and therefore forbidden to keep around. Our beer, just to be clear, which is essentially all made of barley, primarily barley or wheat, is going to be chametz gomer. Okay, and that would be aser, according to everybody in Echi of Kars, to drink that. The third is v'chometz ha'adomi, Edomite or Idumean vinegar. Edom and Idumea aren't quite the same thing, but they're both essentially lands and peoples that are to the southern part of Israel, and maybe also Idumea is this, like at the modern day where the Negev is. Edom could also include like the Transjordan, southern Transjordan area. I believe that Herod's father was an Idumean. In any case, so in those places, they would make their chometz, which is vinegar. Normally, people made vinegar out of essentially fermented wine, like what we would call balsamic vinegar. But here, they added also some chometz liquid, like some part of liquid, to add to it. So again, you have a mixture that includes chometz. And just for the record, barley and wine alone wouldn't make chametz, because we say that non-water, meaning meperos, fruit juices, and mashkin do not cause fermentation. So there's water somehow in the mix as well. So it's a mixture that contains some leaven. The zisom hamitzri, the fourth is the Egyptian zisom. This is some kind of therapeutic mixture, which includes, amongst other things, like flour from barley in the mix, as well as some saffron and some salt and some water. So again, the barley is a minority ingredient, so it's only a tarovus, but still forbidden to keep around. Those are the four tarovus mixtures. And then you have three chametz nukshes, which are zoman shel tzavaim, some kind of preparation that the tanners, dyers of leather would use, particularly to make red dye, so it included barley. So there you go, it's got a mixture that includes barley. But here it's not for eating at all. It's like, it's industrial material, therefore you wouldn't eat it, and it's chametz nuksha. Amalin shel tabachim, this is, I don't know how to translate exactly, but I'll tell you what it is. The butchers, when people would cook things, so, you know, like the scum that floats the top of, like, the soup, so you would skim that off. What they would do is they would essentially take some kind of dough. The dough would be used from premature wheat grains that didn't grow, they didn't ripen yet, and they would make it into like a dough, and they'd use it as kind of like a sponge on top of the pot, and that would absorb the bad taste and bad smell and sort of like a sponge it all away. So again, not for eating, industrial use, and therefore it's chometz nuksha. And the third is the kolan shel sofrim. This is glue, either glue that's made from the fine dust that you scrape off of the mill when you mill the flour, and that would be used to stick pages together. According to Rashi, actually, it's like rye flour, which is used actually in the production of paper itself. But in other cases, it's some kind of glue, not for eating, and therefore it's chometz nuksha. So we have two examples here so far. We had category A, which was real chametz betarovus in a mixture, and then category B was chametz nuksha. It was things that contain chametz, but they're not for eating. Tanakama, however, would say that a mixture of chametz nuksha would not be a problem. However, Rabbi Eliezer disagrees. Rabbi Eliezer omer, af tachshite nashim, this is some kind of cosmetic for women. It was used essentially as like some kind of depilatory or to make their faces kind of ruddy and their skin shiny. The point is, it's a mixture that includes chametz nuksha. So he says even that would be forbidden to keep around. Zahaklal, the guiding principle, says the Mishnah is kol shu mimin dagan, anything that includes grain, dagan, the five grains, wheat, barley, oats, spelt, and rye, hareza over b'pesach, you have to get rid of them on Pesach. That's what Bartender learns, and we're understanding here this is Rabbi Eliezer talking. Now, Rabbi Eliezer is saying, I don't care that it's a mixture of chametz nuksha since it contains water plus five grains, one of the five grains, it has to be gotten rid of. However, the halacha is not like Rabbi Eliezer. The halacha is like Tanakama, that if it's a mixture that includes chametz nuksha, that's not something you have to get rid of. The Mishnah ends up by saying Hare Elu Ba'azhara. Now, there's a couple ways to read this last sentence, but one way is Hare Elu Ba'azhara, and all these things are forbidden as a law, V'ein Ben Mishum Karas, but to eat them wouldn't be considered eating chametz, Gamor, and therefore you're not liable to the penalty of Karas, which is normally the penalty that comes with eating chametz gomor. These are not chametz gomor, they're mixtures or chametz luksha, and therefore you're not going to be chayav karas. Now, some rishonim learn that if you eat a tarovus, you're not chayav karas, it's just a lav. Others learn that if there's in the mixture what's called enough of a kazayas bechtei achilas, a kazayas in every pras, an olive's mount in every, it's hard to translate exactly the words, but it means, but either if the ratio is less than 1 to 1, but it's either, but it's more than 1 to 5 or 1 to 7, it's Machlokas, Rashi, Rambam, whatever, The point is, if you're still eating a kazayas of chametz in the mixture, you'll still be over and chayav karas. So according to those shitas, here this would be Rabbi Eliezer speaking, and he is saying, Hore elu bazhara, the last lines on the list are restricted. The these things chametz nuksha, they're forbidden, but they're not chayav karas because they're not for eating, because they are not. Psachim per gimel Mishnah base 3:2. The first part of our Mishnah will consider the status of dough that is in the cracks and crevices of a kneading bowl, a bowl that's used to knead dough. Now, the Bar Tanura learns that the setup here is that the dough in the cracks is there on purpose to seal the bowl so it shouldn't leak. So these cracks and crevices and maybe holes are filled with dough as like almost like glue, epoxy to close off the and seal up the bowl. Rashi learns the case very differently. I'm not going to go into Rashi here. But if you're learning Gemara and Daf Yomi, of course, you've got to learn the Rashi and see it's a different setup for the question. In any case, in our Mishnah, we say, Batzek she besidkei areva, if you have dough in the cracks of the kneading bowl, kam Pesach, im yesh kazayas b'makom echad, if when Pesach rolls around, you have a full kazayas in a single place, meaning there's one contiguous piece of dough in the cracks, that while you're calling it glue, it's still dough, and it amounts in total to a kazayas in volume, or more, then chayv leva'er, then you must destroy it. Meaning, even though you're intending it to be glue, since there's isuri Pesach, there's an isur of chametz, that confers significance on the dough if it's a full kazayas in volume, and you have to get rid of it regardless. Ve'im lo, if there isn't a single piece that is a kazayas in volume, meaning even if you have 10 half kazesim in 10 different cracks throughout the bowl, batel b'mi'uto, each of the 10 are insignificant in and of themselves, and therefore, since you're leaving it to serve as kind of glue, it's batel b'mi'uto, it's annulled in its smallness, there's like sort of a de minimis threshold that it hasn't crossed, and therefore you can ignore it, leave it be, no need to destroy the chametz in your bowl, because it's functioning as glue, that's how the Bartner learns. Now, if it's just leftovers from not washing a bowl out well, and you have leftover dough in the bowl that's not for glue, it's just a mess. So the Bar Tanura takes a very strict approach here and says that if that's the case, then there's a concern you might actually end up coming to take that dough and ultimately eat it and gather it together, and therefore at all events you must do biur and get rid of that dough. That's the Bar Tanura's approach. Many are much poskim, are much more makel, and understand that if there's not a total of one kazayas in aggregates in the whole bowl, it can be left as is. So you got a machlokas there. Me'ikar adin, in truth, you can be makel if you have less than a kazayas in one place. Everyone agrees that if the dough that's there is dirty, so you wouldn't gather it up and eat it, then in all events, everyone will agree, it need not be collected and gotten rid of. So that's with regard to the Pesach issue. Now, since we're talking about Pesach and the mitzvah of Bir Chametz, we're going to lapse for a second into a question of Tumah and Tahara. So in general, Tumah is communicated from a Tumah source, let's call that an Ava Tumah for argument's sake, like a dead rat, to a recipient, which could be the bowl. The bowl is a kli, and if it touches a dead rat directly, the bowl becomes tame. It's called a rishon, a first three removed tame item. Now, while a bowl can become tame from a dead rat, and an avatuma, a bowl, any kli, cannot become tame from something which is not an avatuma. So that means if you have food, which is tame, and it touches the bowl, so then the bowl would remain tahor. It's impervious, it doesn't become tame from that. So the question of our Mishnah now is, what happens if you have the dead rat and it touches the dough in the cracks? So do we say that the dough becomes tame as food and therefore it can't convey tumah to the bowl remains tahor? Or do we say that the dough is functioning kind of like glue and therefore really it's just part and parcel of the bowl, it is part of the bowl, and when the dead rat touches the dough, it's touching the bowl itself as part of the bowl, and the whole bowl becomes tummy. So that's our question. Now, the Mishnah says, "V'chein l'inyan tumah." The same principle we just laid set out, that if you have a kazayas one place on Pesach, it's significant whether you like it or not. So we're going to similarly say that on Pesach, and this is, get out your pencil and make a note, specifically on Pesach, if the dead rat, the source of tumah, touches the bowl in a place where the direct contact is with a crack which is filled with dough, and the dough is a kazayas in volume, so then we say, since you have to get rid of that dough, because it's a kazayas, because the chiyuv of biur chametz confers significance to the dough all of itself, so then, if the dead rat only touches the dough part, and not directly to the rest of the bowl, so the dough becomes tamei, but the bowl remains tahor. If the dough is less than a kazayas, and since it's functioning as glue, epoxy, as part of the bowl, so then if a dead rat, source of tumah, touches the dough, it's as if it's touching anywhere else in the bowl. The bowl is a composite of different materials, including the glue, which happens to be made out of dough. So therefore, the entire bowl becomes tummy. So on Pesach, you have to make a note to yourself, on Pesach, when the Mishnah says, v'chein l'inyan tumah, the same rules apply, which means whether you like it or not, Hilchos Pesach, the mitzvah of Bir Chametz, confers status to a kazayas of dough, and therefore the dough can intercede and be called chotzetz, can stand between the tumah source and the bowl, if that's the only contact that happens between the dead rat, let's say, and the dough. Now, beyond, outside of Pesach, then the rule is there's no special status per se to a kazayas of dough, functioning as glue. Rather, it just depends whether you're intending for it to stay part of the bowl and not have its own separate status, or whether you don't want the dough to stay there indefinitely. It's not part of the bowl. You intend to remove it later on, whether to eat it or even to throw it away. If the dough is considered to be your makpid alav, you don't want it there forever. You're not abandoning it to be part of the bowl. So then it has a life full of itself, and therefore it would be considered a chatzitza, so much could intercede between the dead rat and the bowl. And it's not a question of kazayas at all. It's simply a question of your intentions. If you intend to leave it there forever, it's part of the bowl. If you intend to remove it at some point, then it's chotzetz, it intercedes. The Mishnah says, so now, with your pencil, make a note. Now we're talking about outside of Pesach, and any other day of the year, im makpid alav, chotzetz. If you are makpid, you intend that you would prefer at some point to get rid of that dough and not leave it on the bowl forever, so then it's chotzetz, it's a chatzitza, it intercedes, and doesn't allow the bowl to become tummy if the dead rat only touched the dough, even less than a kazayas. Vim rotze b'kiyomo, on the flip side, if you intend to leave it there indefinitely, you're happy with that dough where it is, as part of the bowl, as the epoxy, whatever it is, so then harehu kareva, it's considered just part of the bowl, and it's the mixing bowl, and it is part and parcel with it, whether or not it's a kazayas, even more than a kazayas in volume. And therefore, if the dead rat touches the dough, even more than a kazayas, since you're not makpid, you want it to stay there forever, so it's the whole bowl becomes tummy at the same time. Now, just to make sure it's clear, now on Pesach itself, this principle of hakpada, of whether you want it to stay there forever or not, also applies. Meaning, if you are makpid on the dough and you want to remove it from the bowl, so then, even on Pesach, it's going to be chotzetz, it's significant all to itself, even if it's less than a kazayas. The point of the Mishnah in the first part of the sentence was, even if you want to abandon it, and you're not makpid on it, there is a special status of a kazayas of chametz on Pesach, and it is chotzetz anyways. Okay, fine. So that's that. Now, that's the end of that first part of the Mishnah. The Mishnah has another part altogether, which is like a new paragraph, as if it were new Mishnah. The question here is, what happens if you have dough which doesn't have the signs of having fermented yet, haven't leavened yet, I should probably say better. We have some signs. One of the signs of leavening is that you see cracks. One of it is that when you smack the dough, it gives off like a hollowish sound because it's full of little bubbles. So the question is, what happens if you have dough and the dough has been sitting for a while? When you hit it, it doesn't sound like it's begun to leaven, but you have another piece of dough, and that dough was created at the same time as this dough, and that dough clearly has begun to leaven. You see the cracks on it, or if you smack it, it makes the hollow noise. So the question is, since you have two doughs that were started at the same time, but one is not yet making noises, when you hit it, must you consider it leavened already, or could it still be considered to be not yet chametz? So that's our question. Batzek hacheresh. Cheresh is a deaf person. So just the same way when you call out to a deaf person, he doesn't respond because he doesn't hear you. And the truth is, a cheresh also is typically a deaf mute, so it doesn't speak either. So of course, since the deaf person won't respond when you prompt him or her, so too when you smack the dough, so it won't respond and give this hollow sound if it hasn't yet leavened. So if you have batzek hacheresh, but there's another girsa which is to read as batzek hacheres. Cheres is like clay, meaning it's still hard. Like it's hardened up like clay. It's like a brick, a rock. So you don't. It's again not making the sound you want it to make when you hit it because it's hardened. Im yesh kiyotzi bo shehechmetz. If you have another piece of dough which is just like it, meaning it's just as old as this piece, and that piece of dough is hechmetz, it's begun to leaven, so then harehu hareza aser. So then this dough, your batzeka cheresh, or cheres, your dough that isn't making noises, anyways you have to assume that it's begun to leaven, because other dough that's been sitting around for the same amount of time, in the same conditions, has leavened, and therefore you have to treat it as forbidden and chametzik. This will assume you have kind of like this, like, you know, a controlled dough to tell you, relative to this dough, if chimutz leavening has begun. Under normal circumstances, you just have one dough, and it's been sitting around for a while, and the question is, how can you tell if this dough is leavened? So if you see the cracks in it, like we'll see elsewhere, and if you smack it and it gives the hollow sound, then for sure it has leavened. If not, so the assumption is, so if it's been sitting around and you haven't been working it, so after the time it takes to walk a mill, so then it's considered to have begun leavening and becomes totally usher. A mill is like the same word as the word mile in English, same root. It comes from 1,000 paces of a Roman soldier back in the day of Rome, and the pace, which is 2 steps, like, you know, right, left, right, is a pace. So 1,000 of those is a mil, and the Roman soldiers used the equivalent of 5 of their physical feet to be 1 step. So it works out if you actually, the actual Roman mil was slightly less than our modern day mile, a little more than a kilometer. In any case, so the amount of time it takes to walk that distance is considered to be the amount of time where dough is considered to have risen. The Bar Tanura learns, like the Rambam, that it's 2/5 of an hour, 1/5 of an hour is 12 minutes, so 2/5 is 24 minutes. That's the Rambam Shita. However, most poskim, the consensus is, we treat a mil to be 18 minutes, so that would be the halacha, that if dough has been sitting for 18 minutes and you haven't been touching it and working it, so then after 18 minutes, you have to assume that it has risen and is now considered chametz, regardless of what physical features it has in terms of the cracking or when you smack it, what sound it makes. Psachim per Gimel, Mishnah Gimel 3:3. This Mishnah sets forth sort of a conundrum of what to do, and I'll present it actually as the conundrum before telling the answer that the Tanaim provide, then you can think yourself how you'd solve the problem, a little bit of a game. The case is that it's the holiday of Pesach itself, you're on Yom Tov, and you're kneading a batch of dough to make matzah. Now, I know that sounds inconceivable in the modern age, but that they did that in the time of the Mishnah, they were fearless, they made the matzah on Yom Tov, and they just made sure that they did it fast enough that it didn't become chametz. The problem is, if you are preparing a large batch of dough, so that dough would be chayev, obligated in the mitzvah of hafreshes challah, to separate what's called challah, a portion for the kohen. The basic details of that mitzvah, without getting too much right now, is if you're making a dough made of flour from the 5 grains, wheat, barley, oats, spelt, or rye, and the total volume of the flour in the dough is 43.2 beitzim, 43.2 eggs volume, whatever that comes out to be. So then there's a mitzvah to separate challah for the kohen. The challah has a status same as truma, it's actually referred to as truma in the pasuk, and therefore one can't make it tameh. If he does make it tameh, it has to be burned, and if it's tameh, it can be burned, and while the kohen could get benefit while it's being burned, he certainly may not eat it anymore. Kohenim can only eat truma and challah when it's Torah. So, the case is you're making this big batch of dough. It's enough to be obligated in the mitzvah of challah. You and the dough, whatever, the dough is tameh. So, now you have a problem. If you separate the portion of challah as you're supposed to from the dough, that portion of dough will become chametz over time, and you'll have chametz in your house. That's no good. If you want to destroy it, so that's no good, because you're not allowed to destroy kachem, truma, challah on Yom Tov. And if you say, well, let's just cook it, and then we can destroy it after Yom Tov, that will prevent it from becoming chametz, you can't do that either, because while it is permitted to bake on Yom Tov, that's only what's called for ochel nefesh, for needs of the day, that is for cooking, etc. Don't define ochel nefesh right now, but anyways, so for food you're going to eat, you could cook and bake on Yom Tov, but food that's going to get burned and thrown away, you certainly may not bake on Yom Tov. So what do you do? Now, just to make sure this is clear, if we had have the question raised before we start the baking process, the solution would be very simple. Just don't make a batch of dough so big. Make two half batches, each one less than 43.2 eggs volume of flour, and then you've sidestepped the whole issue. You're not going to have to worry about having a parshas challah. But you didn't do that. You have a big batch of dough. It's obligated in challah, and the dough is tummy. So now what do you do? Question mark. You want to pause the recording? Think about what would you do, suggest is to be done. Here our Mishnah is going to have three separate approaches in the Tanaim. Each will have issues with others. The first, so the Mishnah says inside, Ketiv mafrishin chala batuma b'yomtov. How do you separate chala from a batch of dough if the dough is tamei and it's yomtov? So Rabbi Eliezer Omer, lo sikra l'shem an sh'teafe. Rabbi Eliezer says, listen, don't declare it to be chala. Literally, don't call it its name of chala, meaning don't separate challah or call it challah, until after you bake it. Meaning he says, listen, you got a lot of dough over here. You make yourself a dozen loaves of bread or whatever the story is. So put all dozen loaves in the oven, cook them all. Then take one of the loaves that you've baked, put all the loaves, technically put them back in a basket, and then for whatever reasons I don't get into right now, they'll go into a basket, and then you'll take one loaf, you can take the smallest of those loaves, and declare that one to be the challah. Kohen can't eat it because it's tamei, but you don't need to burn it because it's not going to become chametz now. And after Yom Tov, you'll give it to a Kohen, and he can burn it. And if he wants to use it as a fuel source while he's burning it, more parrot to him. So that's Rabbi Eliezer's elegant solution. The problem is Rabbi Yudah ben Maseira doesn't like that because it's turning out in the rearview mirror, lemafreya, you know, in retrospect, that you baked this loaf of bread and you didn't need to. It's a loaf of bread you weren't planning on eating. So you're really doing the prohibition of baking on Yom Tov, something that's not food for consumption. So Rabbi Eliezer isn't concerned about that because he says that at the time of the baking, it's not any one of the loaves were eligible for eating. Just after the fact, you decided to declare one of them to be challah. And more than that, you actually could have, each and every loaf could have been edible, just you had to separate a little piece of each and every loaf as the challah portion. So he says that it's not a problem. Everything is eligible to be cooked and baked because you haven't declared anything to be challah yet. But Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseira doesn't like that at all. He says, nope, since in retrospect it will have been doing some baking of things that aren't food for eating, he forbids it. So instead he says, Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseira Omer, tatil batzonen. He says, just put it in cold water. His thinking is that if you put raw dough in cold water, that will impede the leavening process, the chimutz. It won't come to become leaven, chametz, as long as you keep it nice and cold. Now, Rabbi Eliezer doesn't actually disagree with that. He says, in principle, it's true. If you keep the dough cold, it won't actually become leaven, and you could keep it in cold water, under ice, until the Yom Tov is over, and then after that you can quickly destroy it, or whatever the story is, before it becomes chametz. The problem with that, according to Eliezer, is it's like, you know, playing with fire. If you don't do it properly, if you're not careful and you let things get warm, so then it actually could become chametz. You don't have chametz in your house, and that's certainly no good. It's Pesach time. So therefore, Eliezer prefers his first solution, but he actually would agree as second best to Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseira's plan, meaning he says at the outset, first bake it all and then call it challah afterwards. But Rabbi Eliezer would say, listen, if you separated the dough and you called it challah, so now you've got a ticking time bomb in your hands, so don't let it turn to chametz. Instead, keep it in cold water, and that should be fine. Just make sure you keep on switching up the water every so often, keeping it nice and cold, so that the devil doesn't become chametz until after you're able to destroy it on after Yom Tov. The third shita is Rabbi Yehoshua. And Rabbi Yehoshua doesn't like the solutions that they provided, but he says it's not a big deal at all. Amar Rabbi Yehoshua, lo zehu chametz shemuzharim alav b'bal yirah and b'bal yimatzeh. Rabbi Yehoshua says the whole thing's not a problem, because although it's true you can't have chametz on Pesach, the Torah is specifically talking about your chametz, not someone else's chametz. The pasuk says, v'lo yira'eh lecha chametz, v'lo yira'eh lecha sa'or. You will not see for yourself chametz or sa'or, that, you know, leavening agent. But the understanding is the lecha means chametz shelcha. Your chametz is what you can't have. But if it's not yours, you could have it around, and it's not restricted. We discussed this a little bit briefly before when we're talking about non-Jews' chametz in your home. We said that's, in the introduction, as I said, that's going to be permitted, assuming you don't have responsibility for it. So Rabbi Yehoshua says the same thing applies over here. Since once you separate it and you call it chametz, it's no longer yours. It's the property of the Kohanim, the nebulous, undefined group of people called Kohanim. That's not you, and therefore you're not liable for it to be in your home. As far as the Kohanim, well, every individual Kohen hasn't received it specifically. Since no specific Kohen has taken possession of this chametz, no Kohanim are in trouble. And therefore, says Rabbi Yehoshua, that's your best move. And that sidesteps all the issues. Rabbi Yehoshua, furthermore, doesn't like the idea of, like Yehuda ben Sera, he doesn't like the idea of baking it, because in the rearview mirror, like we said, in retrospect, you ended up having baked things that you're not allowed to bake, that wasn't meant to be eaten on Yom Tov. So that's Rabbi Yehoshua's solution, and therefore he says, I didn't finish reading the whole thing. He says, "Lo zehu chametz shemuzharim alav, but bal yivira and bal yimatzeh." This was not the chametz that we were muzharim alav, that we were literally means like warned against, but it means forbidden. But bal yira and bal uvaval yimatzeh, when the Torah said you may not see and have chametz, ella mafrashta. He says rather separate it, umanachta ad erev, put that chametz. Oh, excuse me, I should say, put the dough aside until you'll destroy it on Motzei Yom Tov. Vim hechemitza, hechemitza. And if it ends up leavening, so then it leavens. What's the problem? It's not yours, and therefore it's not forbidden. The Baruch Hu says the halacha is like Rabbi Eliezer, which means that ideally the way to do it is to, if you have such a scenario, is to first bake it, and after that be koreshem, declaring what's challah. But indeed, if you're ended up separating it first, and now you've got this dough in your hands, so then you can follow Yehuda ben Sera's suggestion of keeping it in cold water and making sure it doesn't become chametz until after Yom Tov. Psachim, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Dalet 3-4. In this Mishnah, we are asking the question of what happens if you have three women who want to bake their matzahs in a single oven, and the oven is only big enough for one matzah at a time. So may they all commence the kneading of their dough in preparation of their matzahs simultaneously, or should we be concerned that since there'll be like a line waiting to get your matzah into an oven, that in the interim their dough will become leavened and therefore become usur? So the Mishnah says, Rabban Gamliel Omer Shalosh Nashim Lashos Kachas. Rabban Gamliel says three women could knead simultaneously, Va'ofos Betanur Echad Zuachazu, and then they can bake their matzahs in their oven, one after the other, meaning the other two women have to wait their turn, and we're not concerned even that the third woman in line, her dough would become chametz in the time that she's waiting. We're not concerned about that because, if you recall, we say that dough takes the amount of time it takes to walk a mill before it becomes leavened. The Baruch Hu, like the Rambam, says that's 24 minutes, we paskin 18 minutes, but the point of Rabban Gamliel is that 18 minutes is a long time, and there's plenty of time for all these women to get their doughs in the oven, and no one's dough is going to come to chametz, and there's nothing to be worried about. The Chacham Omrim Shalosh Nashim Oskos Babatzek Achas Lasha V'Achas Arechas V'Achas Ofa. Chacham say nothing doing. We're not going to let that happen because we're afraid that they won't arrange things properly and dough will come to become leavened. And therefore, we say they can't start all at the same time. They have to stagger their commencement of the kneading. And since there are sort of three phases to the process of manufacturing matzah, you have step one, which is the kneading. That's called lisha, or lasha in the Mishnah. She kneads. And then the second stage is the oreches. It's the arranging of the little matzah loaves. You might imagine that as cutting the squares and rolling the rolling pin to make the holes, but that's probably not what it looked like in the time of the Mishnah. But that doesn't matter. The point is you have to take the batch of dough and arrange it into the shape that you want it to be shaped for your matzah. That's called the oreches, when she arranges it. And then finally you have the afia, the baking, or as the Mishnah says, ofa, she bakes it in the oven. So the chum say you have to stagger it, that first Mrs. A starts with the kneading, and when she finishes kneading, and she'll go on to the second stage of being arranging oreches, then Mrs. B will start her lisha, her kneading, and then when Mrs. B finishes her kneading, then Mrs. B can go on to doing the arranging, Mrs. A can go on to the baking, and Mrs. C can commence with her kneading. And in that way, no one's sitting around idle, and then nothing will go wrong, and no other doughs will come to be chametz. In other words, the chum are saying, you can't do it all at once, you have to stagger it out. Rabbi Kiva Omer, lo kol ha-nashim v'kol ha-kol ha-eitzim v'lo kol ha-tanurim shavin. Rabbi Akiva is coming to explain the Chacham Shita, and he's saying there's a reason why we're not going to be so lax about the whole process like Rabban Gamliel is, because even though it's true under normal circumstances, 18 minutes, let's say, is a long time, and baking matzahs takes a few minutes, and therefore there's no reason to suspect that just three women, total two waiting in line, even the second one waiting in line, matzah will come to chametz. Rabbi Akiva says, listen, none of the thing works exactly like you think, and there could be bottlenecks in the process you didn't anticipate. Like, for example, lo kol hanashim, are not all the women are equal, meaning some women happen to be very slow kneaders and move things slowly, and then, therefore, the gap of time could be longer than you expect. Similarly, lo kol ha'etzim, not all wood is shoven, not all wood burns, catches on fire as quickly, burns as well, therefore things might not go according to plan. And finally, lo kol ha'tanurim shoven, not all ovens are equal, some ovens cook and bake faster than others, and therefore things could go wrong. So Rabbi Akiva's point is simply, you can't just make a blanket rule that three women could definitely start at the same time, because sometimes the process takes longer than you expect. Different stages are not what you'd expect them to be. Halacha is like Rabbi Akiva, meaning like the Chachamim, that they would have to start in a staggered way, one after the other. Now, really, the next words here, according to the Bar Torah, and everyone besides the Rambam, is like a new sentence. It's not Rabbi Akiva speaking, it's just a Stam Mishnah talking again. The Rambam has a slightly different girsa here. But anyways, like the Bar Tanur and everyone else, this is a new point here. We say Zeha Klal, there's a general principle. Tafach, if the dough that one's making into matzah begins to appear to it's getting ready to start inflating, so then you want to impede the chimutz, the leavening process. So what you do is Tiltosh Betzonen, the woman should wet her hands with cold water, and then sort of use the cold water on her hands to rub over the surface of the dough, keeping the dough cold, because when you cool off the dough, that will impede the leavening process and keep the dough from becoming leavened even for a long time. So that's the rule, how you keep dough from expanding if it's sort of waiting to get baked, etc. Psachim, Per Gimel Mishnah Hay, 3:5. We said up to now that if you leave dough for 18 minutes or 24 minutes, the amount of time it takes to walk a mill, so then if you are not agitating it, then for sure it's become chametz. But if things are warmer, it's very possible that the dough became leavened and chametz sooner than that. So when we have physical indications that the bread has begun to leaven, then already it's too late. Our mission will set forth different levels of the leavening process, if you will, where things have just started, and then maybe they could still be, the bread could still be either permitted to eat, or at least not forbidden under penalty of karas, etc. So we have two basic stages here by name in the Mishnah. One is called Seor, or Seor, and that means it's, you know, partially leavened. That's stage, I'll call it stage one. And then you have a second stage that's called Siduk. Siduk means cracked, literally, has crevices. And that's really stage two. We're going to say that si'ur, that first stage, is not yet chametz proper, whereas siduk is. But what defines se'or versus siduk will be machlokas. And one important point of clarification. We spoke about se'or with the shiva. Se'or being the leavening agent, that sourdough which is used to make other doughs rise, the source of the yeast. So the se'or of the pasuk with the shiva is like chametz gomor. It's completely chametz, and one who ate it would suffer penalty of karas, etc. One has to destroy it for sure. This word se'or or si'or is totally different. It's something totally different. We're referring to dough not that's super duper leavened and beginning to spoil, but rather dough that's just starting to leaven and therefore actually is not usher yet midoraisa. So the Mishnah says se'or, when it comes to the se'or, yisaref, one must burn it before Pesach comes in. V'ha'och l'pater, but if one eats it, he's pater, meaning he's not liable to karas or even to malchus. So the obligation here to destroy it before Pesach comes in is because this se'or has the status of chametz nuksha, which is on the beginning of the perek. It's incompletely leavened, and therefore it's actually machlokas if it's the rice, the rabbanon, to get rid of it, to burn it. But either way, there's certainly an obligation to get rid of it, but if you do eat it, it's not yet chametz gomer, so you'll not be liable. That's stage one, se'or. Stage two is siduk. It gets cracks, and at that point, yisaref. It must be burned. V'ha'och l'chayev karas. Since it's now considered to be chametz proper, so if one ate dough that reached the point of siduk, by the time it was baked in the oven, when one eats that, it's considered to be chametz gomer, and therefore it'll be liable to karas. Now, we have to define these terms. So, ezu se'or, what constitutes se'or? So, the first sheet of Rabbi Yehuda says, kekarne chagavim, it resembles the antenna of a grasshopper. So, those are two tiny little, insect antennae are tiny. Those are cracks that are appearing on the surface of the dough. So because it's starting to leaven, it's beginning to crack. And like the same as the carne chagavim, the grasshopper antenna, they are not only tiny, but they're also not connected. Like they're like almost like, I'll call them parallel lines, if you will. The carne chagavim, those antennae are going in different directions. They're not touching each other. So when the little tiny cracks are emerging and they're not connected one to the next, that's called se'or, and that's where it's chametz nuksha, and you can't have it, you have to destroy it, but if you eat it, you'll be pater, says Rabbi Yehuda. Siduk, that second phase, where it is chametz proper, when it's got cracks, shinis arvut stakav zebezet, when those cracks begin to grow and they connect one to the other, so now you have connected cracks, at that point it's chametz gomor, de Rabbi Yehuda, and at that point it would be chayv karas if you ate it. The chacham omrim, zebezet ha'ochlo chayv karas, they say no. Whether it's got cracks the size of diverging tiny cracks like grasshopper antennae, or whether it's connected cracks, it's all the same. That shows it's begun to leaven. Cracks mean leavening, and therefore you'd be chayv karas, say the chachamim. Their general principle is, ein lecha kol sedek v'sedek milamala she'ein lo kamet stake milamata. It's like the tip of the iceberg. If you see just a few cracks on top, even like karne chagavim cracks, beneath the surface, inside the dough, there's tons of little cracks appearing, and it's leavening proper. So therefore, if already tiny, non-connected cracks are stage 2, and chametz gomor, ve'ezuhu se'or, when is the stage 1 according to the chum, where you have to get rid of it, but if you eat it, you'll be pater, kol shehichsifu panav ka'adam sha'amdu sarosav. It's anyone who literally means its face is embarrassed, I will translate it as in like the famous expression from the Zohar, Nahama de Chisufa, if you're familiar with that expression, Nahama de Chisufa, the bread of shame, whatever that's referring to. So this is like the ashamed dough. But here it refers to someone actually who's a person whose hair stands on end, Ka'adam Sha'amdu Sarosav, that means a person who is, if you go pallid, you go white with fright. So when all the color drains out of your face because of your fear, so you kind of become blanched and pale, and that's what happens to the dough. When the dough yet hasn't begun to crack, but it's changed color to go that pallid, more white color, that's already indication that the chametz process is just beginning. That's called the chametz nuksha, and that's where you have to get rid of it, but if you don't get rid of it, then if you eat it, I should say, you'll still be putter from the doraisas. Now, the halacha is like the chachamim, so therefore we say, if it's 18 minutes, we paskin for sure it's chametz. Less than that, even the tiniest cracks tell you that it's now chametz and has to be burned under penalty of karas. If it even starts to get white, it has to be burned as chametz noksha, but if one ate it, it's not an isur d'oraisa. Psachim per gimel mishnah vav 3:6. This mishnah is coming to answer the question about what do you do in terms of the procedure of birach chametz when erev Pesach falls out on a Shabbos. Obviously, you have certain restrictions, and the question is, should you then do your birach chametz a day early on the 13th, the Friday, to avoid those problems? So we have three shitas. The mishnah says arba asar shechalios b'Shabbos. If the 14th day of Nisan, erev Pesach, falls out on a Shabbos, the first shita says mevarn es hakol milifneha Shabbos, divrei Rav Meir. Rav Meir holds you have to do your whole birach chametz before Shabbos comes in, with the exception of enough chametz to last you the first two meals of Shabbos, on Leil Shabbos and Shabbos morning. You don't need shelo shudas because by then already, of course, the time has passed and you wouldn't be able to eat chametz anyways. Rav Meir holds that there is the possibility that you won't find people to eat your chametz or animals to give your chametz to, and then the next thing you know, the time will pass. And so you're not really accustomed to Shabbos, and the next thing you'll have chametz on past the deadline. So therefore, you have to destroy it before Shabbos. Chacham v'chacham omrim bizmanan. The chacham say no. You can wait till the proper time, meaning the 14th on Shabbos, and probably it's free food. You'll be able to find lots of people who'll be happy to eat at your Shabbos table for lunch and dinner. And if you can't find people, you can find animals to give it to, etc. And in the event that you don't have enough people and animals, okay, so there's plenty of ways you can get rid of your chametz in a mutter way on Shabbos, nothing to be afraid of. You can feed it to dogs, you can ultimately flush it in the toilet, you can give it to goyim. So plenty of options of what to do on Shabbos, Erev Pesach, if there's no one to eat the chametz. And therefore, the chachamim say no problems beforehand. Now, we haven't differentiated between Truma and Chulin. The next shita will. According to the Chachamim, while you have your options to keep your chametz until Shabbos, and you certainly could destroy your chametz before Shabbos if you want to, when it comes to the Truma, if you have Truma that's chametz dik, since there's a separate mandate from the Torah requirement to protect Truma from loss and destruction and Tuma, so therefore you would actually not be allowed to do birach chametz early on your truma, that's chametz dik. You would definitely have to save it until Shabbos, and then either find a kohen to eat it, or ultimately, when the deadline's coming, and once you've reached, the beginning of the 6th hour, you'd have to destroy it by a mutter way, down the toilet, give it to dogs, or whatever else you have to do. That's a chametz shita. Rabbi Lazar, Bar Tzadok, Omer, truma milifnei Shabbos, v'chulin bizmanan. Rabbi Lazar ben Tzadok differentiates between chulin and truma. He says, when it comes to chulin, since anyone can eat chulin, you're going to find lots of people happy to eat free food, you'll find guests, no problem, and therefore, there's no reason to destroy your chametz early, bring it to Shabbos, and you'll find people to eat it, and if you can't, then you'll dispose of it by dogs and goyim and toilets, etc. However, when it comes to truma, it's highly unlikely that you're going to find enough people to eat that truma, because it's restricted to kohanim, and you don't have that many kohanim handling necessarily. And according to the Bar Tanura, you can't feed it to animals. Rashi learns elsewhere that you actually could feed, if you're a kohen, you could feed it to animals, and if you're okay. But the Rambam, the Bar Tanura, both learn that you cannot feed your truma to animals, even if you're a kohen. So therefore, we're concerned that truma will not be able to be gotten rid of in time, and therefore, according to Rabbi Elazar Bar Tzadok, the truma must be gotten rid of ahead of time, whereas the chulin, you can keep until the buzzer on Shabbos itself. Now, the Bar Tanura says v'halacha k'Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok, that the halacha follows him, meaning that you must get rid of your truma early. The Bar Tanura over here is going like the Rambam and the Perash Mishnayos. The Rambam himself, in the Yad, contradicts what he wrote in the Perish Mishnayos, and the Rambam in the Yad Hilchos Chametz Matzah, Per Gimel Halacha Gimel, says that you, like the Chachamim, that both Chulin and Truma should be destroyed before Shabbos come in.
and that we'd have you'd have no concerns. And that's how the Shulchan Aruch paskens. So, therefore, Allah Lamaisa, notwithstanding the Bar Tanura, you should be rid of all of your chametz, both chulin and truma, before Shabbos comes in, save for enough chametz for the first two meals of Shabbos. Psachim, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Zayin, 3:7. This is actually quite a famous Mishnah. It says, Haholech lishchot es pischo. If a person left home on his way to Yerushalayim now to go do shchita, to offer his korban Pesach, v'lamul es beno, or if he's left home to go on his way through the mitzvah of bris milah on his son, here the vav, the coordinating conjunction, which usually means and, means or. V'leachol sudas erison, again, the vav here means or if he's left home to go eat the mitzvah, the sudas mitzvah, the festive meal of erison. Erison is the same as kedushin, like the first stage of marriage. We do when we, like, say, give the ring under the chuppah. That's erison. The beis chamav, in the house of his father-in-law, which suggests we're talking about his own sudas erison. He's going now to celebrate with his own wife. So the Rambam, however, seems to suggest that any sudas mitzvah will be fine. In the time of the Mishnah, just so you're clear, there were two stages to marriage that were separated by a span of time. Nowadays, we do the erison, which is the kedushin, and the chuppah, like, back-to-back. But in those times, there was a space of time. So we're first, he's getting, I'll call it engaged, for lack of a better word, but it's a word, but it's a terrible, terrible translation. He's giving the ring. Then she'll be forbidden to the rest of the world as his wife, I'll call it his wife or future wife, whatever you call it. And he's now going to do that mitzvah. In all those cases, v'nizkar shi'esh lo chametz besoch beso, he remembers that he left home to do his mitzvah, any of those, or any other mitzvah for that matter. And then he remembers that back home he hadn't gotten rid of his chametz yet. So what should he do? So the Mishnah says, im yachol lachzor ulevaer v'lachzor lemitzvaso, if he has enough time to go back home, do his bir chametz, and then get back in time to do his other mitzvah, his shechitas abesach, his attending of the suda, etc., the bris milah of his son, so then yachzor v'yivaer, then he should do both. He should go back and do his bir chametz as he's supposed to, and then go back through his mitzvah. However, v'im lav, if there's not enough time, meaning if he would go back home to do his bir chametz, he wouldn't be able to get to do his korban Pesach, whatever it is, on time, then mevatlo belibo, we let him just do a bittel. If you recall, midoraisa, we said that you're mekayim the mitzvah of tashbisu, of hashbas, of getting rid of your chametz, by simply being mevatel it, considering it to be either ownerless or like dust. Machlokas Rishonim there, exactly the lumdus, whatever it is, it's for sure sufficient midoraisa to do simple do bittel. There's a din de rabbanan, you actually have to physically rid yourself of the chametz. It's also exactly the technicalities we discussed as machlokas there, and why that was the case, to have this din de rabbanan. But the point is, it's just a de rabbanan, and the rabbis who made it de rabbanan did not intend for it to be in force when one would have to go back through this derabanan at the expense of foregoing another mitzvah. So if that's the case, he can just mevata belibo. Now, mevata belibo literally means annul it in his heart. And there's a machlokas Rishonim if that means just simply thinking that my chametz back home is ownerless and like dust of the earth, or if he actually has to explicitly say those words. So that's a separate machlokas. Either way, that will be sufficient. Important side point. If it's already arrived for the time of Bir, meaning the sixth hour has arrived, so now there's no longer the possibility of simply doing Bittel. It's no longer effective. He'll have to go back and get rid of it physically, and so long as he's not doing it, he's over the Isser Doraisa of maintaining Chametz, and that being the case, if you're in the sixth hour when he remembers, or after that, he'll have to go back. He has no choice in the matter. He has to go back to destroy it. Now, the second part of the Mishnah will talk about scenarios not just of generic mitzvah, but of the more supreme mitzvah of Hatzalas Nefashos, of saving Jewish lives. And here it says, if Lahatzel min Hanachrim, he's headed out now to go save a Jew from, according to the Girsa and the Mishnah in front of us, Nachrim from the Gentiles who have come to attack. The Bar Tanur had a different Girsa of min Hagayis. A Gaius is like a marauding army, but to the point that you're saving Jews from being slain. Umin ha-Nahar, or he's setting out to save Jews from a river which has overflowed its banks, which of course could threaten people's lives, umina listim, armed robbers, umina deleika, or a fire that broke out, and he's going to save people from the fire, umina mapolis, or if there was a building collapsed, yivata belibo, then at all events, even if he has enough time to run back, still he shouldn't, because even Safak Hatzalas Nefashos takes priority. So he should not delay. He should keep on going. And regardless of the timing, he should be Mevata Belibo. He should annul it in his heart. Velishbo Shvisas Harishus. Now, new point here. If he's going to do Shvisas Harishus. Now, what that means is he wants to adjust his Tchum for Yom Tov. On Yom Tov, like on Shabbos, a person can only walk 2,000 amos beyond the perimeter of his what's called Makom Shvisa, his home base for Shabbos, which is complicated to define right now and not our topic. And we actually just learned Erevin. So the point is, you could stand in a different place as Shabbos Yom Tov comes in, and then call that your Makom Shvisa, and then you could adjust the boundaries, the tchum in which you could walk on Shabbos. So this person is headed out now on Erev Yom Tov to go stand out in a particular place. So when Yom Tov comes in, he will define his Makom Shvisa by where he's standing. And that way he'll be able to walk, go to his buddies for lunch on Yom Tov. So that's not a mitzvah. And that being the case, if that's what he's out to do, Belishbos Shvisas HaRashos, he's going to establish a Shvisas HaRashos, a voluntary residency, if you will, on Shabbos, a Makom Shvisa, home base, or Yom Tov, I should say, either way. Yachzor Miyad, he has to go back immediately. That's simply disallowed, since it's not for the sake of doing a mitzvah. He has to go back all the way, wherever it is, to go and get rid of his chametz, even if it means, of course, he won't be able to now get back in time to set up his Makom Shvisa. Important to understand that if he were doing this adjustment of where his tchum is on Shabbos to stand there for the sake of doing a mitzvah the next day, whatever that would be, whatever mitzvah that would be, to go hear his Rebbe speak or something in the next town over, so then that would be considered the same thing as the other mitzvahs in the first part of the Mishnah, and he would, yes, be allowed to do that. There is a side kasha, which Tosfos asks, which is, you're never allowed to adjust your Makom Shvisa and do a set up like a different Erev Tchumen if it's not for the sake of a mitzvah. If that's true, says Tosos, then how could ever be a case where we're talking about what is not for the sake of a mitzvah? So one possible answer is that we differentiate between using bread as what's used to set up your Makom Shvisa, food, like the picnic basket that will define your symbolic home on Shabbos, which you cannot do if it's not for the sake of a mitzvah. But there are those who say it would be permitted to do that, not for the sake of mitzvah, if what you're doing is not using bread, but just simply using your own person. You're standing in a particular place as Yom Tov comes in. That would be okay, even for a Devar Rishus. So, good. Psachim, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Ches, 3:8, the last of the Perek, and this Mishnah actually is connected to the previous. In the previous Mishnah, we had talked about the requirement under certain circumstances to go back to do Bir Chametz, even though you left already. Our Mishnah will consider the question of when you have to go back to burn your Kadshim Kalim in Yerushalayim. So let me explain the backstory here. Sacrificial meats had to be eaten in very specific places. There are two categories of sacrificial meats, the more sanctified, Kadshei Kadshim, and the less sanctified, Kadshim Kalim. Kadshei Kadshim must be eaten in the temple courtyard, the Azara, only by the Kohanim. Whereas Kadshim Kalim, the lesser sanctified meats, can be eaten anywhere inside the walls of Yerushalayim. Now the rule is that if you take the meat outside of the zone in which it may be eaten, so then the meat becomes invalidated and has to be brought back to where it's supposed to be eaten and burned over there. So our Mishnah is going to talk about a person who had some Kadshim Kalim in his possession, and instead of eating it, he had some left in his Tupperware, and when he walked out of Yerushalayim, he took the Tupperware with the Kadshim Kalim with him. So now he has to go back and burn it. The question is, just how far out of Yerushalayim he can be before we say, listen, it's too much to go back, burn it where you are. So that's the question. So the mission here says, V'chein. The same kind of principle applies regarding going back, but here we're talking about Kadshim Kalim. Misha Yatzim Yerushalayim. if one left Jerusalem, v'nizkar sheyesh biyado basar kodesh, and he realizes, oh, I have some kachim kalim in my possession, so do I need to go back to burn it in Yerushalayim, go schlep all the way back there? So it depends. Im avar tsofim, sofer bimkomo. If he's past the place called Sofim, so then he must burn it, then he doesn't need to go back. He can burn it when he remembers. So the word Sofim, which is related to the word litzapot, to look out, to view, kind of like related to the word tzipisa li Yeshua, the famous question to ask after you die, did you look forward to the redemption, anticipate the redemption? So tzipisa litzapot, Sofim, same word. So some of us understand there's a specific place called the Tsofim, and if you pass that place on the road, you don't have to go back. Others understand the word Tsofim is a general expression for any place where you're able to still see the Har HaBayis. If you can still see the Har HaBayis, so then you are within the zone called the Tsofim, the place where you can see it, and that's the place from which you have to still go back. In modern Hebrew, we have Har HaTsofim, Mount Scopus, which is a mountain upon which you can, like where the Hebrew University is, you can look over and see the Har HaBayis. You have a view of it. And the word scopus, like the word, you know, scope out, telescope, etc., means to view, same idea. So that was Mount Scopus, but I'm not necessarily sure if Tsofim and Scopus are the same thing at all. Maybe no connection. I don't know. In any case, so if you pass that place called Tsofim, then you don't need to go back. Sorfo bimkomo, you can burn it right where you remember. Vimlav, if you have not yet passed the Tsofim, then Choser, you have to go back, Visorfa Lifnei HaBira. You have to go back to Jerusalem and burn it in front of the Bira, Me'ate HaMaracha, with the wood of the pyre from the altar. So just, let's just go slow here. The word Bira is literally means something like the mansion or the castle. And it's a machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, if it refers to a specific building on the Har HaBayis, outside of the temple complex there, called the Bira, and according to Rabbi Yochanan, that's where you do your burning of Kachim Kalim. According to Reish Lakish, the entire temple complex is referred to as the Bira, and you have to just go over there somewhere to burn it. Now, technically, since Kodshei Kodshim can be eaten anywhere inside the walls of Yerushalayim, so you could burn it anywhere inside the walls of Yerushalayim. So here we're not saying that you must go back to the Bira to burn it over there. We're saying you may go back to the Bira. And if you go back to the Bira, then you will be using Atzei HaMaracha, wood from the pyre. That is to say, if you want, you have a home in Yerushalayim, you have access to wood, you can just burn it wherever you want to burn it inside Yerushalayim, and that's acceptable. If, however, you don't have your own wood, or you don't want to provide your own wood because you're a cheapskate, so then you can go to the place called Bira, and they will provide you with wood. And if you go to the Bira, you must use the Atzei HaMaracha, the wood from the temple supply that's used on the pyre there, to burn it. And that's an important provision that we make to make sure that people who are cheapskates don't say, I'm not going to bother burning it because I don't want to pay for the wood that it takes to burn it. So either burn it wherever you want in Yerushalayim on your own dime, providing your own wood, or go to the Bira there in the Har HaBayis, a specific place, or just a general place there, and you'll be provided with wood from the Atzei HaMaracha, the wood from the pyre on the altar, and there you will burn your Kodshei Kodshim, which left Yerushalayim. You might ask, how could you use wood that was dedicated for the use on the Mizbeach for burning some pasul Kodshei Kodshim? The answer is, Kodshim Kalim, I should say, sorry. The answer is, you would be right in thinking that, but the Beis Din said that when people consecrate the Kedusha of the Atzei HaMaracha, the wood for the pyre on the altar, so included in that is a condition that you can use it to burn invalidated kachim. Okay, so we walk away from that saying that you don't have to go back if you passed the Tsofim. If you didn't pass the Tsofim, you must go back. But beyond that, the Mishnah wants to know if there's some de minimis exemption where the amount of meat you have is so small that even though you haven't yet passed the Tsofim, it's just not necessary to go back to Yerushalayim to get rid of this tiny crumb of meat. So this Mishnah now kind of comes full circle with the previous Mishnah, and we're going to ask for the requisite amount that forced you to go back to burn your Kachim Kalim,
Gosh, I hope I didn't mix it up earlier in the Mishnah. If I did, I'm sorry. The whole Mishnah is about Kachim Kalim, the lesser sanctified. If I mixed it up, I apologize. Before. And also, it now wants to query our, based on our previous Mishnah, when we said you have to go back to do your Biur and your Chametz. We're asking how much Chametz we're talking about back at home that makes you go back to rush back, if you're going to go rush back before rushing forward again to do your mitzvah, whatever your mitzvah was in the previous Mishnah. So, we're going to have three Shitas. The Mishnah here says, V'ad kamehen chozrin, for how much do you have to go back for? So Rabbi Meir Omer Zeveze b'kabetza. Rabbi Meir holds that both for chametz and for kachim kalim, the amount for which you have to go back is a kabetza, an eggs amount. And Rabbi Meir's shita is based on this, his principle that chazaraso katumaso, the amount that forces you to go back, is the same as the amount which, let's say, conveys tuma. Everyone agrees that foodstuffs, ochlin, can only convey tuma if it is in a volume the size of a kabetz and eggs volume. There's a machlokas, by the way, if food less than a kabetz can receive tumah. But everyone agrees that it can't convey tumah until a kabetz in size. And therefore we're saying that if food, ochlin, whether it's chametz or whether it's kachim kalim, how much does it mean a significant amount of food? Enough to convey tumah. If it's less than that, it's not significant, and therefore you don't have to go back for it, neither to burn the kachim kalim, nor to go back to do beer chametz if you're rushing up to do a mitzvah. That's the first sheet, Reb Meir. The second sheet is Reb Yehuda. And Reb Yehuda Omer, Zeveze Bechazayas. He holds the measurements, the limit is a kazayas. And it applies both to going back for chametz, if you're running through a mitzvah, as well as to go back and burn your kachim kalim. Both are at a kazayas. His rationale is Chazaraso Ki Isuro, what defines something, food stuff, as being significant at the threshold where you have to go back for it, is at what point it becomes forbidden. So the same way the one who could be liable for kares for eating chametz on Pesach in the amount of a kazayas, one olives amount, so that's the amount you have to go back for, and similarly, one would be liable for eating forbidden kachim kalim, sacrificial meats that left Yerushalayim, if the amount that went out is a zayas amount, a olives bulk amount, and therefore that's the amount for which you have to go back for. Finally, of the Chacham. The Chacham differentiate. They say, Basar Kodesh b'chazayas. When it comes to going back to burning your Kachim Kalim, then even a Kazayas amount, a Kazayas is half of the Kabetza, so even a Kazayas amount will require you to go back. We're more strict when it comes to Kachim, because Kachim is generally more strict. This is Kachim Kalim. Whereas the Chametz, when it comes to Chametz, which is less strict than Kachim, b'chabetza, you don't have to go back to burn it for your mitzvah unless you have at least a kabetza of chametz left behind. The halach is like the chachamim, so that means for kachim you have to go back even for kazayas to burn it, but when it comes to chametz, if you left to do your mitzvah, you don't have to go back unless you have left a full kabetza's worth of chametz back home. Less than that, you can lecharchila go do your mitzvah and just be mevatel your less than a kabetza amount of chametz in your home, in your heart, or verbalize it as the machlokas is, and that's going to be sufficient.